Hurra, hurra! Ein Design-Podcast der Burg. Okay, so while you were looking for your book, I just make the introduction. Hello.
Hello.
And a warm welcome to a new episode of the Hurra Hurra podcast. This time, as you already hear, it's in English language because we have an international guest. This is Anup Jain. Hello, Anup.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, and we have you switched to us from London. And to bring everybody in, I just go quickly through the CV that is posted on your Superflux website, and you can correct if something isn't really right. So it stated that Anup is a designer, futurist, filmmaker, and educator. She is a co-founder and director of Superflux, and she catalyzes the studio's mission to leave a meaningful legacy for our planet and its future custodians. So it's quite poetic written. And through that, Anup, you grew up in India, and you have an honorary doctorate. You're a Royal Designer for Industry awardee and studied filmmaking and interaction design. And since 2016, like 10 years from now, you are, have a professorship in Vienna at the Angewandte. Is that all in all correct?
Yes, that is correct. Thank you.
Cool. And we are here because I basically wanted to talk about you, about your practice and how do you interweave it with your educational work. But then, like, in the way of finding the date, your new book was published. And so we take the chance to just talk about your new book that has been published at the Hatje Kanz editing house, and you released it with Nicolas Heep and Stefan Zinell, and it's called Designing Questions. And as this is an interview and we have to, basically it's my work to design a question as a designer, I designed a few questions, but first I want to basically just take your designed questions from the book to dive into that. First, why that book, Anup?
Yeah, it's a good question.
That's a stupid question, but it's a good starter question.
It's a good starting point because, so as you said, you know, I've been leading a program that we renamed Design Investigations. It used to be called Design Industrial Design 2. I inherited the program from Fiona Raby, who was already kind of pushing the work to be more critical, more speculative. And when I joined the department, there was a real interest from the students to call it something that foregrounds the way we think and practice a bit more. And so when we decided to call it Design Investigations, over the last 10 years, it became clear that we were really actually exploring quite a lot of different topics at different scales, whether it's thinking about how we design windmills, or what does it mean to live in a world of food insecurity, or what does democracy even mean today. We were inviting our students over the last decade to grapple with the ways in which the role of the designer will shift in keeping with the complexity and change in the world around us and where the future is heading. And so it became quite obvious over the years that ultimately the kind of questions that the students were asking became even more important than the answers, because there are no simple solutions to a lot of things that we are talking about. If you think about it, design solutions, solutions under quotes from the world of design, is also part of the problem. that we are at, if you think about it. So the way to ask questions meant that we took off from the students the imperative to come up with a solution. And instead, come up with proposals or come up with biases and assumptions and experiments and myths and stories and prototypes and ways to unpack that question that might have a strange and interesting sort of reference to the world or the question or the brief. And that's why we decided to call the book Designing Questions. And I do want to add that it's my partner, John Arden, who came up with the title, because he said that the work we do at Superflux is also actually designing questions, because we ask questions like, what might it feel like to live in this world, or what might it mean to live in a world where, and so that's really what we've been doing. Yeah.
In your book, you quote a person that said there is a difference between a first education, which is referred in that case as the industrial design legacy that you also have in your program, and the second education that builds up on this. And because my first question was, what does it mean to have design investigations? Mm-hmm. You cleared it up easily. And also that's answered in the book in a way, but I really like the fact that there is the concept of a first education and a second education. And can you just go a bit more deeper? I think it's a woman called Olivette. Oh, shit, I have the quote wrong. Her name is, wait a second.
Vanessa Andreotti.
Yes, that's true. Yes, Vanessa de Oliveira Andreotti. That's true.
And what comes is, up what with is that. In? Would you remind me the quote in particular that you're reading right now?
Of course. I cite you. I'm often asked why design investigations? Why not a more familiar name? Moving from established labels seems risky. Parents and careers, parents and carers worry about the career and prospects of our students. Yet this unusual name feels necessary. The valuable lessons of industrial design legacies, I don't know how to pronounce, are not dismissed by this shift. They constitute what Vanessa de Oliveira Andreotti, who participated in the panel discussions, including in this book, describes as a first education that gives us language, concepts, and ideas to play and experiment with. Yet, in the face of the challenges that lie ahead, we need to commit ourselves to what she calls a second education, which demands that we loosen our grip when these things get confused, or the past itself, when they become the summit of our end. It gets super confusing. In your words.
So I think, actually, even before I had read Vanessa's book, which is Hospice in Modernity, which came out a few years ago, the rhythm of the course, because we are taking in quite young students, this is a program that starts after school for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So they go from coming off and out of school, or they've done a little bit of internship or apprenticeship or explored the world, and they come to us quite young, our students, and they stay with us for 5 years. I was quite sort of clear, because of a practitioner myself, that it was important that the students get two types of skills, practical skills and conceptual skills, so that they can go out in the world and be practitioners in whatever fields they're interested in and develop that practice further through a skill that allows them to practice in the world and make a living, so to speak. And then the conceptual rigor that we wanted to bring with that was the idea that you have the skill to think about things through many different perspectives. So you start to have an orthogonal view of the world in a way. So you sort of unpack, and that I think is what Vanessa talks about as a second education, is that once you have the language and the skills and the vocabularies to make prototypes, to design films, to explore materials, then you can start to think, what is the provenance of this material and how might things be shaped differently, not just in an object, but in the world around us, in the relationships, in the way that we explore more than human relationships even. So in a way, that is the second education, where they use their first education to ask deeper questions. And the way it works out quite practically in the department is that we have every year we have two semesters. And so we go between a conceptual semester and a practical semester. In both the semesters, students of course ask conceptual questions and learn practical skills, but we focus a bit more on material skills in one of them and on deeper questioning in one of them.
Is it a class system at the Angewandte, so that they study just in design investigations, or do they shift in between the departments?
No, so it's a class, it's a department system, and the students sign up to design investigations, so they follow our curriculum. The way it works is, which is I think true of quite a lot of European universities, that they then have to go and sign up to different courses. So they might learn geometry, and they might learn theory of design, and they might learn art history, or they might learn tinkering and model making. These happen sometimes within the department offers it, but quite a lot of time it's classes that other tutors around the university offer, and they sign up to.
Like also theory modules and stuff.
Exactly.
Okay. As in this quote that we had in the beginning, there was the question of careers, and you have a very particular and specialized practice with Superflux, as I see from the exhibitions I was, and I know a few studios that go in the same direction as you. Is it your aim to create or to enable these students to set up studios and practices like yours, and do you have some sort of kind of proof or best practice for that? Because it's not 10 years of design investigations. Can you tell? Where do they go? What do they lead to? Where do they impact?
Sure. So I think that the ambition of the educational program is to nurture a sense of agency, a sense of curiosity over and above anything else, a rigor of practice, a sense of a certain scholarship around the practice, a sense of deeper skills, and then absolutely the choice to do what they want with that, armed with that sense of agency and skill out in the world. So over the last 10 years, several of our students have continued to develop their diploma projects that they did in the university. There are a few students who had an idea that got traction while they were doing their diploma and ended up starting what you might call a startup of a product idea. For instance, a student was working with the idea of lichen that is edible, and then she ended up making a drink from it, and now she's working with stone. And so that's one direction. Another student was working with aquaponics and now has a whole fish aquaponics.
I visited them. Is it? I saw it in Vienna. I visited with the students, I guess, once.
Yes, yes. So that is, of course, Living Farms that Katrina had set up many years ago. But this is Philip Lloydot, who set up, I actually don't remember fully the name of his company, but yes, about 2-3 years ago. And then you have some others who've set up research fellowships and research and design fellowships building on there. So there's that angle. There's some who have decided to become more artistic practices, have won awards and gone on to do more artistic work. There are some students working in studios like IDEO, doing bike design in a really lovely school studio in Vienna. Some have got into education, research. Another has started, a few of them have started a collective together. So there's really a real breadth. And some of them find their feet straight away. And some take longer to figure out exactly what it is that works for them. And it might, their journey might be more of a exploratory journey. But it doesn't really matter who lands where. It may take longer or shorter. The point is that they, over the years that they are with us, they start to develop a particular interest. So when they get a brief, they don't have to design a product. They could design, for instance, performance. And then you have a student who is developing a set of performances over several years. And that becomes their sort of focus area, if you like. So I think it's kind of, we are very rigorous in our approach, but that rigor is in the interest of the students having choice.
Yeah, and that is what differs to the regular educational system, where the choice is not so much given. As you say, you even say it in the book, or quite in the beginning, that these students are quite young. Yes. So you say that like between 18 and 23 or something in the around about. Often the students that that I have or that we have here at the Burg Giebichenstein, they're typically a bit older. So they dive in like in their beginning of the 20s, or they even have an apprenticeship before, and they come as cabinet makers or boat makers or what. Ever so, they come with a certain approach before, and even they have to be unschooled before before the studies in a way. Yeah. So I really like the fact of developing a particular interest, as you said, as a core value of the studies, because we cannot offer everything in that short period of time.
Exactly, and the thing is that. We do have students. I do want to say that there are students who do come with degrees already. Like we have students in their 30s even, and you know, who want to change. You know, we have a student who's been a really successful landscape architect in China for a long time. We have a student who used to have a very successful hairdressing practice for many, many years. So, and then we have slightly older students and younger. So I think there is a fairly mixed group, but I think the students who come after school, they are shaping their interests. It's early days. While those who have chosen to come back to do a 4 or 5 year program have obviously chosen because they want to change that journey, you know. And that's so interesting because it speaks to the idea of potential. Because, you know, when you are born and when you go through school and then you go through university, when you're born, you have so much you might call potential, right? Or possibility. You could be this or this or this or this or this. But then very soon you start narrowing, and this is it. And then you sort of do that. But that's changing so much, and that's not how it has to be. Like, you know, we have made these ways of being in the world. These are rules that can be unmade. And people can choose to explore their potential in different directions.
And if we stick to that idea of developing a particular interest, it's a process, and that means you try out a lot of particular interests, and through this you learn a lot about the world and things. And in your book, the the samples of educational projects is super broad. So things go from very technological projects that go beyond tinkering, that are quite elaborate, also using AI agents and stuff, to installative works in the urban field, and even talking about your project design for abundance, even beyond urban into the rural areas in Austria. I don't know the federal state it was. I want to ask you a question that I'm very interested in, because you're a professional in that. And also in your book, there's a whole chapter on the question, why does design has to speculate? And the whole speculative design buzz, as it raised with a speculative everything, moved a lot. So we are not 10, 15 years back again, so we are now. How do you think the practice and the educational work around this has changed or developed, and to what does it developed in your case? Because you've been on it maybe from day one, but still there.
So I think that to unpack that, I think there are two parts to it. One is for me as a practitioner of this sort of what you might call speculative design, what does it mean? And I have to admit that we in the studio, John and I and our colleagues, we never really see this as a design discipline in the way you might think of graphic design or product design.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it's an approach or a philosophy. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of doing things. So it's a way of seeing the world. It's a philosophy of understanding what it means to explore a bit of an open-ended potential around ideas, to see where they land, what are the consequences, potential and consequences of these ideas, and these sort of things and technologies and things we put out in the world, how might we relate to them differently, and what is the impact of their relationship to our lives and so on. So you might think of this practice as something that sits on top of a very multidisciplinary design practice as a perspective. So that's what we bring when we say, why should design speculate? It's because design has a responsibility, and designers have a responsibility to understand what does it mean to use a certain kind of material to make a certain product. What does it mean to design a system that is open-ended or closed? What does it mean to design an urban infrastructure in a particular context? These things have lives that last beyond the designers and the consumption patterns that we are caught up in. So when design speculates, it starts to foreground some of these systemic and tangled relationships that our designs create or become part of. And so when you understand that this is all in relation to each other, that there are unintended consequences, you might take a different stance in how you design.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thinking that we are bringing and I am bringing to this book, but the book is a summary in a way of the thinking of the department.
I really like the fact that you said that this kind of speculating is part of a multidisciplinary working approach. So it's like a tool in your toolbox that you take out in a certain part of the process to gain kind of perspective, or gain a deeper insight into things, or a broader understanding of connectivities in between certain dots that are around, or that you go beyond the presence into certain future foresight moments. Right?
Yeah.
Did I get it right? So, and to follow that,
say,
Or
I would say it's, sorry, it sits before you reach out to your toolbox. So that's what I was trying to get at, is that it's perhaps that reaching out, that action of opening the toolbox and reaching out, it is embedded in that cognitive action, so that when you reach out to your tool and start making something, it exists within the relationship between the mind and the body in a way. So sounds a bit abstract, but it sits before or outside of the tools you're using. So it brings a lens to the way in which you use the tools.
Okay.
I think.
No, because designing questions. I designed a question. It comes to that because it's as you said, it's abstract. It's quite a model that is in your head or that is not quite tangible yet.
Yes.
How do you accompany the students from air quote regular design expectations to design investigations? So it's a question on the how, not the like. How do you soften them or to sharpen them to unlock this potential they have? And then I ask this as a design as an interested fellow design educator.
Sorry, I missed that last bit.
No problem. I ask this as a fellow design educator. So I'm really interested in the methodology of how to get the students, these young students that maybe have been unlearned and a bit unschooled already, but have to get deeper in that beyond tool practice, as let's call it like that.
Yeah. And I think that is the job, and I think that's the work. It's really what I find very, very exciting, and why I'm still doing this is because of that, because I really enjoy that process of working with students to be able to sit with that uncertainty that, okay, so I'm doing this and I have done all this research, but there is how does that become a concept? Or I have done this research and I want to build this, but resist building that thing straight away because that's a form, but what does it contain? And when you take away that container, or when they have to come up with a container themselves, when the container of a designer sort of an aid for someone or something which is very specific and practical and is equally important, but when that particular layer isn't there, then what should I hold on to is often the main question the students grapple with. Now, I think we are fortunate because students who apply have done a lot of research, so they already know what they're getting into and want to do it because they've chosen to do it. And it is what's written on the tin. That's what you get. You're not secretly saying we do graphic design, but actually, oh, you know, I'm never going to, like, you know, there's nothing ambiguous about the course. So it attracts people who are interested in this more or less, young or old. And then within that, it is many different pedagogic tools we use. You know, students work in groups, some small groups. There is a vertical studio system, so groups are paired from first year, second year, third year, fourth year together. Mm-hmm. There are Erasmus students and students from other departments who come and join. There are a lot of crits and feedback sessions and conversations. We have workshops and we have lectures and some field trips and all of that thing that is in the towards the interest of the topic of the semester. And every tutorial and every second session we have with the students every week is about furthering their exploration. And it is not easy because, you know, sometimes it takes 6 weeks to do research and then it's like, oh my God, but now it's midterm review. And there are deadlines, the practical things, and things have to come out and you have to make stuff. So how do you sort of deal with the reality of the semester and the requirements that we have versus this kind of very abstract or often undetermined process? And that dance of traversing, the labyrinth. It's traversing that labyrinth where there is one way, but you're fighting it out. Versus what is timid goal uses that the fixed. What's the opposite? What's the other word of the labyrinth? Maze. The maze, which you know it already. It's predetermined in a way. So our process is very much about inviting students to not rush to solutions too quickly. Sometimes coming into experiments quickly rather than doing a lot of desk research. My students often make fun of me because I keep using the word thinking through making. So they're always laughing.
Why do they laugh?
They're always like, they'll, you know, cheeky ones will put it up on a slide. Now I did some thinking through making. And it's basically like, I love it because it's really, you know, they're trying and everyone's prototyping. Everyone's different, has got different ideas. It really fills me with joy and gives me a lot of sense of hope and optimism for the younger generation.
Yeah. And talking about this thinking through making, in your book there's a whole chapter on the making aspect, and that makes me, or that I was quite happy about it, because I follow that approach. You come from I'm a very Eurocentristic person in a way, so yeah. I come from Donald A. Schön with the reflective practitioner background, but you came up with a totally different approach on that. So you came from you basically, what I really liked is, okay, there's a different view on that making background. And so can you, I know I designed a question. How do we experience the importance of making?
Yeah, that is so difficult to articulate, isn't it? And so powerful when it works. So when you start, you've got this idea, you know, in abstraction, you've got this idea of that something will work. And then when you get the paper and the pen and you scissors and you cut it and it doesn't hold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do you do next? You try something else, and then you try it. And it's basically the power of experimentation and iteration and prototyping and all this, whatever language you use, your mind and body forms a relationship with that material in that moment. And it's giving you feedback and you are giving it feedback and you're working in a relationship with each other. Whatever that material is, right? It could be wood, it could be paper, it could be straw, it could be a bunch of different things. It could be storytelling. You start writing, it could be writing, it could be a sound. So I think that thinking through making is the way of deepening the relationship we have with sort of any form of material that then allows us to create a more embodied sort of expression of the proposal or the question. So it sounds abstract, and I'm only saying it in this way because it's really, at the end of the day, it's really just try different things out. Keep trying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think what you said is that making is relation making in a way.
Yeah.
Super interesting. And why do we designers do set the making quite central is because this is the way we start understanding world, because if we do not cross-check our expectations, and we cannot simulate weight visually. We can this in a bit, but is it true?
Yeah.
And so can we experience that? And if we say that the under the bottom line, what we designers do is create sensual experiences for others in an industrial design like way, or maybe it's on a graphical visual way, but it's all about, you don't see this, dear listeners, but I'm just doing this with my hands. Oh, it's awesome. It's like, it just like it has to be in between the fingertips or something, that it starts to be graspable and real. Because what a lot of stuff that, if we talk about potentials are not there yet. And a lot of stuff that is design related is in the designers, if you could say so, if you follow the division of the mind and body, but it's all in the person's whatever thing.
Yeah.
So this is quite cool to have the making as world making and sense making. And then if you train this in this 5 years of educational setting that the students go in, it's quite a good base to move on into different design related fields.
Exactly. And
in your book, you describe a project that is called meditative making, or I don't know if I'd get it right. And as I saw this, I was super jealous because I thought, oh, well, that's a project I would like to do with the students as well, because the making itself is essential, but the meditative aspect of it is super underrated. Can you tell a bit more about this project and your approach and the results of it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that was a full credit to my colleague Stefan Zinel, who came up with that idea of calling it meditative making. We wanted to call something that is focusing on making, and we all just loved it, because like I said in the beginning, we have a semester where we do more conceptual work, and then a semester where we do more practical work. That one semester was a semester after the students had done the After Abundance. It was a lot of, like, you know, big, large scale working. There was exhaustion coming out of it. And we wanted it to be a nurturing semester where people can explore their prototype build. And then the focus became making windmills, or parts of windmills. So every student eventually chose a certain material that they wanted to design this windmill in. And that's what it was. It was whether they were working with wood, or whether they were working with metal, or whether they were working with foam, whatever material. I suppose the meditative bit, you know, you can understand it's like doing the same thing repeatedly in a way that is calming. Obviously, there wasn't like hours and weeks, maybe hours, but not like weeks and weeks of doing the same thing. But it was finessing that blade of the windmill. It was the outcome was about 7-8 little windmills, and together they were able to get a little bit of power. And so it felt very sort of very much like a collective experience. You know, some worked, some didn't work, some worked a little bit. You know, it did matter so much as that you understand a few things about how difficult it is to think of. We think of energy in abstraction, but when you have to do it, you realize how much you have to do to get a little bit of energy. So there was also the idea of quantifying something abstract and then working with materials. Yeah.
I saw that I find a bit of contrast between that wording meditative making and then quite technological and complex results came out of the course as these windmills or energy harvesters for wind, because I thought that refocusing on repetitive craft of like zen-like, maybe it's carving or some sort of weird knitting traditional work that in the result is not a super innovative design, but in the process celebrates embodiment and calming, because in the book Designing Questions you also state that we have this overlying parallel crisis in different worlds that come to the young people so near through social media. So to find navigation, orientation in these confusing times, these meditative practices might be necessary to don't go crazy.
Yeah. Which I completely point taken, and yes, definitely it probably became more ambitious and complex than we would have liked to have in the beginning. Admittedly, over three and a half months, it was quite slow, and a lot of process of making and cutting and designing patterns and stuff. So, but it makes me think that maybe we should do that again.
Yeah, I recommend.
Feel like we should definitely do another one of those properly meditative semesters.
Another question is about the designing in abundance, design for abundance. I don't get it right.
Designing after abundance, you mean?
Design after abundance, excuse me. Right. Which was centered in the rural areas of Austria. And there is a whole publication at Birkhäuser to it. We put it in the show notes for everybody to read, and also in the in the Designing Question book. There's it comes here and there. The projects pop in, and it's some sort of exotic excursion from the urban design field towards the rural and decentralized areas of Austria. And my question is, did a few of the young designers later went to the rural areas to stay there and to set up a practice there? So did it had an impact to bring young creatives to the landside?
So I would say the impact it had was that those became the thematic concerns for many of the students throughout and continue to be now after graduating. So for instance, one of the students, Sophie Falkes, who was on the team of doing glaciers, which was an afterabundance, went on to do a project around Close Encounters, and is continuing to do research fellowship looking at landscapes and mountains a lot, I think, in fact, in Switzerland. So Felix, who was also part of the glaciers, went on to do a diploma film called Brute Force about how do I even describe that? But a sort of an essay film looking at the complex really entanglements between technology, terraforming, and politics. So I suppose some students already also live in rural parts of Austria or have come from rural Austria.
Yeah.
So we have students who have come from a lot of parts of Austria already. So they do go back as well. So there was never this, the urban-rural divide wasn't actually that strong even from the beginning, because a lot of students who were in the first and second year working on the project had come from different parts of the country, and even in and around Bregenzerwald where we went and spent some time there. So I think it was more around the concerns or the questions that the projects raised had a deeper impact, I think.
The book Questioning Design somehow marks a review of the last 10 years at the Design Investigations. While working on it with your colleagues, did you also could find not just a retrospect, but a prospect? So did you learn something from looking into the vaults to what kind of perspective does it offer you if for that reflection?
Yeah. So I think that for us, actually, the book is as much a vision setting as much as an archive. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about all the chapters, they are positing what we think design education should be for the years to come, a certain kind of design education, I would like to add. Not all, but there's room and space for this kind of approach. And we have anchored it with evidence of things that have happened so far. So I think we have to, how do we design when everything is entangled is what we are saying. How do we do it when we go out? How do we design through making is the question, like, how do we move forward? So each of that question becomes a question as a setting of a vision of how do we move forward?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, we said we'd make it a short. We had it short.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Hey, thank you. That was good. I made a lot of notes. I learned a lot. Like developing a particular interest as something that resonates, because often we, maybe not we, but I, demand so much from our work to make them career ready, to make them super critical, to give them self-reflective powers and stuff. And sometimes maybe this overshoots our competence or our time that we have with the students. So maybe it's in the core that they develop a particular interest and gain skills to do so and to take it further even after the university is something that that gives me some sort of relaxation in a way to, it's okay to do so. And also that focusing on making it's now written in the book. It's now there. It's not just some sort of idea that floats in between our fellow design educators, but now it's written on an extent in the book.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that. Blah, blah. I'm happy with that, and I hope all the listeners had fun as well. And pardon my stuttery English from time to time.
No, not at all.
Anup, take care, and thanks for being our guest. To everybody listening, in the show notes we have a link to the book. Get it from your favorite bookshop. Support the these infrastructures and. We hear us in the next episode. So, bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Hurra, hurra. Ein Design-Podcast der Burg.